Next case is 001886, State of Ohio, Australia, United Auto Aerospace and Agricultural Implement Workers of America versus Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation.
May it please the court, Chris Dolly, as special counsel to the Bureau of Workers' Compensation and Administrator James Conrad, I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. I am before the court today seeking the reversal of the Court of Appeals vacating of a one-time 75% reduction of employer's 1999 future premium payment. The basis of the Court of Appeals decision and the issue before this court is the legal interpretation of the term future premium, as that term is used in 412332.
And it seemed to me, much like the last case, that it's a semantical argument. There's no question this order was issued March 11, 1999, is that right?
That's when the administrator...
It was to remit, if you will, or deter or lessen obligations created the prior January 1, 1999 through June of 1999. Is that correct?
Well,
it affected that reporting period.
It was for the payroll reporting period of January 1 through June 30th of 99, which would be due in August of 99.
Okay. Now, how do you make March 11, an order of March 11, forgetting maybe that nobody's injured and we know the purposes of the funds and all that, how do you make a March 11 order prospective to something that occurred January 1? Before March 11.
Well, what I would say is that the term future premium, certainly as interpreted by the Bureau and as interpreted by, or at least as in the dictionary definition, would be a payment which is due in the future. And that was the interpretation that the Bureau gave to the term, that since the money was for a payment in the future, and in fact the payment was, when you made the payment, you got workers' compensation coverage for the future, that it's a payment.
I think that's a circular argument. That's my point, is semantical. I just want to look at the clear facts before us. I had acquired an obligation or incurred an obligation as an employer as of February 1999, hadn't I? Whatever it might be, from January 1 till February, I owed something for workers' compensation.
If you report payroll,
yes,
in June of 30th of 99, you would owe something for...
They come along in March and say, I don't have to pay those premiums or as much of those premiums. How is that either cash or affecting a future premium when, in fact, I've already owed the premium January, February, and March?
Well, I guess what I would say is it is my position that future premium means a payment which is due in the future. And it would also certainly seem to me to be a much more reasonable interpretation of the term future premium to be one that, if you look at the statute itself, 412332 says we could issue a cash refund. We could actually take money from the fund if we have an excess surplus, which the facts show we clearly do, and return it.
Why did you do that? Then you comply with the statute.
Well, I mean, the reason it wasn't done in this case is because a decision was made that they wanted to collect, you know, 25% of the money that the employers were going to owe in August of 99.
This is the only time frame that's in dispute in this litigation, is it not?
This is the only premium reduction?
Right.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, this is
but
the only one that's in.
This is not the only time this was done. There have been subsequent 75% reductions?
There were prior reductions and there have been subsequent reductions.
In the subsequent ones, has a different procedure been followed?
We have complied with the interpretation that has been given to the term future premium.
By the Court of
Appeals. By the Court of Appeals. Now,
so the subsequent reductions of 75% have been done in advance of the time period running for which the premium applied.
That's correct. They would be, let's say if it was announced in March, it would be for the premium that would be due almost a year later, the following. If it's March the 99, it's for the premium due.
If it's announced in March, it would be due for the premium for the time frame that began to run July 1.
July 1 through December 39, due February 2000.
And what about the prior reductions, the ones prior to 99?
The ones prior to 99 would have been done consistent with our interpretation of future premium and how it was done in this particular case.
But they're not in dispute here.
They've never been challenged and they're not in dispute.
In fact, the 99, the January period that was used, the payroll period that was used here, January of 99, the premium coverage would have been paid for that before, wouldn't it? If you pay in advance, that would have been paid sometime before January of 99, would it not have been?
When they would have paid in the prior year, they would have had got coverage for that particular period of time. That's
so
correct.
You wouldn't go back and, I mean, the argument is that this is not a future premium because you're using a January 99 period, a payroll period upon which to base the premium, but that's already been covered.
That is correct. Yeah, and the other thing I think that's important because it's not, you know, the court, we never had an opportunity, this issue was never briefed, raised, argued ever in the Court of Appeals, is the impact that this decision has on the Bureau's management of the State Insurance Fund, because this has really created great uncertainty and difficulty in analyzing excess surplus in the fund. Because if you look at now what we have to do, we have to be able to project what is the surplus going to be a year in advance. When we decide now we have all this extra money in the fund and we have to return it, under the facts of this case, we only had to be sure that surplus existed 3 months later. Now we have to be sure that surplus exists a year later, and in fact we have to be sure for public employers who pay annually, we have to be sure that the surplus is going to be in existence 18 months later. So what this is now causing the Bureau to do is to really engage in greater uncertainty in administering the fund and determining its obligation as to what the surplus is going to look like in a much later period of time in the future. I can't imagine that the Court of Appeals ever intended to really put the fund at greater risk than it currently as in this particular case. We certainly believe that the interpretation that we gave of future premium.
I'm having a hard time understanding your logic there. If in March you determine there's enough surplus due to investments, that's what happened here, is the investment portfolio
and management of the fund, yes,
it did well. Is sufficient that we only need 25% of the normal premium for the 6 month time frame? If you have to move that out 6 months later to give that break, I assume the fund remains fairly constant in terms of its take, its inflow, does it not?
Well,
there aren't big spikes up and down.
But what we have done is what we have to do is we have to maintain a surplus in the fund too,
right.
And the surplus in the fund must be at least based upon our analysis and the actuaries 2 to 2.5 times right. Annual premium base. So,
I mean, isn't your argument that by delivering it 6 months later, we could look foolish because the market could do what the market recently did, and so the surplus that we said was large, 6 months later, it turns out it wasn't that big a surplus.
Exactly.
But you would have looked equally foolish whether you delivered it the first 6 months of the year or later. I mean, that...
Yeah, but it's much more likely that we're going to be able to predict the performance of the fund 3 months from now than we are 18 months from now. I mean, in those 15 months, there certainly could be a number of events which could occur which could impact the value of the fund. Here, where we said we've got so much money, we're going to return $633 million.
I didn't understand your response to Chief Justice Moyer's question about it already being paid for. You're not suggesting that you're paying in advance into the fund, are you, the employees?
No, I think what we were talking about is that when you pay, like in this instance, when you pay in August of 99, based upon payroll reported from January to June 30th,
right,
you get coverage for July 1, December 30.
No, that's not really what you're paying for, though. You're allowed to continue coverage just like a new employer gets coverage for 6 months before they get a bill.
That's correct. I mean, I guess I'm not sure that I...
Well, you're not paying for future coverage. Your payment enables you to maintain the coverage that is billed after the fact.
The Bureau will give you 6 months of coverage based upon the payment that you make,
right,
in the prior 6 month period of time.
Well, they're not giving you anything. They're billing you for it at the end of the period.
The following...
You lose qualification for coverage if you don't make timely payments when they're due. Isn't that the way it works?
You would lose qualification for the coverage if on August, let's say the facts of this case.
If on August 30th you haven't paid.
You haven't paid.
Then you're out.
You would not have coverage.
Right.
And they would pursue collection. That's correct. Certainly, again, when we go back to the term future premium, if you apply rules of statutory construction, you first look at the plain and unambiguous meaning. I think we meet that standard. If the court would find that we don't and that somehow it's an ambiguous term, I think even under that standard, this certainly has to be a permissible or reasonable interpretation of the statute. Again, we talked about we could do a cash refund. We talked about it makes more sense from a fiscal standpoint to interpret this way, and certainly it's consistent with dictionary definitions of the term. I'd also like to speak just briefly on the issue of mandamus in this case. I don't believe mandamus was the appropriate remedy to bring in this particular case. What the realtor sought in this case was an injunction. I think the complaint certainly demonstrates that. They requested an order not to grant the premium reduction. What they were seeking was an injunction, and in fact, if you look at what the record in the Court of Appeals, they tried then to seek an alternative writ to stop the granting of the premium. And what the Court of Appeals said is really what you're asking is for an injunction. We don't have jurisdiction to give injunctions. We can't give you one. You brought an action in mandamus.
Counsel, what is the status of that time period? Was the reduction carried out?
Yes. Yes, the reduction was carried out. They sought an alternative writ. The court said that's an injunction. We can't give injunctions.
So if we affirm, what happens?
If you were to affirm the Court of Appeals decision, I suspect that what the Bureau would have to do is they would have to bill employers for the 75%
You suspect you're here as their counsel and you don't have a...
They would have to...
You lost, and you don't have a plan as to what is going to happen if you lose here as well?
Well, I think what they would have to do is issue a bill the employers for the 75% that they didn't collect. You know, and I don't think, again, that certainly is not, in my mind, consistent with the interpretation of future premium. I see my time
is... when the council, this council composed of, I guess, management and labor both agreed with the administrator that the reduction was due, necessary.
That is correct. The reduction has to be done with the approval of the Oversight Commission. Labor, management, consumers all have representatives on that commission.
Right.
They all agreed that the reduction was necessary and appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dolly. Mr. Minzik.
May it please the court. My name is Steve Minzik, and I'm here on behalf of United Auto Workers today. First and foremost, on behalf of directors Lloyd Mahaffey and Warren Davis, we'd like to thank you for granting oral argument in this case. We have heard some things in this. Understand the central issue in this case is whether or not the Bureau lacked the power to grant this dividend and the rebate, because they did grant both. It wasn't just one under the workers' compensation law. The only statute at issue is 412332.
Counsel, I'm having a hard time understanding what you hope to gain by doing this. If they had the right to give a cash refund and they opted administratively to do it as a premium reduction, because it seemed to me that was a whole lot less paperwork than a cash refund, and the commission, Oversight Commission, agreed there was a need for the reduction, what did you hope to gain by all of this litigation and taking all of this time and effort?
We hope to gain to compel a public figure to obey the law. 32 is specific and mandatory and says if the Bureau decides, and if the Administrator decides he can give it back, he may, that's permissive, that he shall adopt a rule. They never did. Shall adopt a rule.
So your main objection is they didn't do...
Follow the law.
If they had done the rule, they could have done this?
The objections would have been different. It would have been, as the second part of our argument, as to the constitutionality of whether or not they could give the refund. The premium reduction, they can set rates. 29 and 34 says they can set rates.
Can they give a refund? Are you disputing the fact that can't even give a refund?
If it's a refund, yeah. That's the second part of our argument, that the constitutionality of that is not, because it's a trust fund. This court has said in a number of cases it's in the nature of a trust fund solely to be used for injured workers and their dependents.
So you dispute that they could have given any refund at all. They would have had to just keep the surplus and make future reductions in premiums, and your future is a year later, not 6 months later.
No. They could have made rate reductions under 29 and 34, which would have applied without any weight. That is, we believe the General Assembly set forth this specific procedure in 32, which is much more restrictive and mandatory, by saying if you're going to do anything with the surplus fund, you have to have a rule in place. Let's not just do this helter-skelter and say, well, we're going to give back this much, we're going to reduce these premiums as a dividend refund, but you can set the rates. 29 and 34 is only needed, all we need for that is advice and consent of the Oversight Commission. 32.
Well, instead of saying a 75% reduction, they had simply said, your rates are 25% of what they used to be. You wouldn't be here?
No.
So just the words that they use, reduction versus new rates, is what you're squabbling over.
No. The section of the code that they did it under, if the administrator would have taken action under 29 or 34, which he's permitted to do only with the advice and consent of the Oversight Commission, he can set rates, and they're permanent rates, and he can change them whenever he decides to change them, and he can actually set rates rather than trying just to return monies. This was nothing more than an attempt to return money, $633 million into the economy with absolutely no restrictions on it whatsoever.
Why should there be restrictions if the legislature has said to the Bureau, if you determine with the advice of this advisory council, everybody's represented on it, that actually you've been collecting too much money from employers, and so we think this shouldn't be fund money, this should be the employer's money, because if they're paying too much money into the fund, what's wrong with that as a policy matter?
Nothing, except that wasn't the part of the statute that the Bureau used in
well,
this.
Well, your first argument was that there's no rule, but your second argument is, as you said, is that somehow the employers are going to use this money for purposes other than for injured workers. Well, so what? I mean, if the fund is solvent and it has the funds in it that it's supposed to have in it, it's no one's business what employers do with money that they don't have to pay into the workers' compensation fund, is it?
If it's a rate adjustment or 29 or 34, that would hold true. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about money that's already in the fund. It's a trust fund. It's set up for injured workers and their dependents. It's only set up for that. It's not set for anything else. Now we're going to say we're going to give this money back. We're going to give it back without any impositions as to what you use it for, not to make a safer workplace, not to prevent injuries, not to educate the employees as to how they might not get hurt. Just do with it as you will. It's a trust fund. It cannot be disturbed for that.
So if my insurance agent says to me during the middle of the policy year, we realize that you don't need to pay as high a premium as you did, so we're going to give you a refund, that would be an unconstitutional act.
We're not saying that. We're saying under 29, Mr. Conrad could have said, we're going to lower rates permanently, whether it's 75%, 25%, whatever, and you're not going to pay premiums on this. And he could have done that. He chose to pull out of a different statute, 412332, which says he may, not he shall fix rates, not he can fix these with the site.
Give a refund.
Right. He may do it, but only if he adopts a rule. He didn't do that. That's required under Chapter 119.
Let's talk about that. You cited a couple of cases in which that hold that there has to be a rule. They were both cases, two of them, I think, the lead cases, were cases in which there was no statute. An agency just did something on its own without statutory authority. Here, as you know, the argument is that whether it's a statute. And so the Bureau, they didn't adopt a rule, which they should have done. But there are protections because the statute says pretty much what has to happen. What's your response to that?
The statute in 29 or 34 may say what has to be done in those. 32 is mandatory. Those two are permissive. It's different. Crossett versus Conrad, this court held an unambiguous statute is to be applied, not interpreted. The Bureau wants you to interpret this in light of other statutes. That's not what's to be done here. In 32, it says he shall adopt a rule. What's the purpose of the rule? Why would we have to have a rule? Maybe it would allow the administrator to say, let's look at what these surpluses may be 18 months from now, as you've heard. Let's have testimony on them to see if the fund is going to be solvent. Nobody can plan for things as a downturn in the economy as it is now. What happens? Not only for injured workers, but what about employers now that have this money back and may be faced with rate increases? They've already had two rate increases with this.
Can you interpret the mandatory rule making requirement as being a 119 hearing?
Yes, absolutely. And if you look to the case, I think the Hoover case, which the magistrate cited, in your dissent in that, Justice Douglas, you went through and specifically noted, and that's what we're talking about, 29, 34, 35, which are not at issue here, don't require it because they're exempted from a 119 hearing. 32 is absolutely not exempted. 32 is a mandatory statute. That rulemaking process has to be done through the Bureau, through hearings that they're going to have at the Bureau first, then through the legislature, it goes through JCAR. Everybody has a chance to present testimony, to present evidence, and to present some other side to it. That's what wasn't done here. It's required. If it's required, I don't understand how they get around that.
And if they had paid it back in cash or credited it against future premiums, they wouldn't have needed a rule.
No, if cash or free future refunds, they would have needed a rule. That's 32. If they would have just reduced premiums, not future premiums, 32 is a return of monies. 32 is not setting premiums. 29, 34 sets the premiums. 32 says if you're going to return them, you can return it either in the form of cash refunds or a reduction in future premiums. There's no question that it's not a future, that it can't be a current premium. There were questions before about how the March, what happens if an employer goes out of business on March 1st? His premiums are already there. The surplus is announced. Is that a collectible debt? Sure it is. It's a matured debt at that point in time. 78 even allows for the administrator and mandates the Bureau go after and put a lien on the properties if that's not paid. It doesn't extend the payment of the premium at the time that it's due in August for the period January through June. If it's paid on time, yes, coverage will be extended if you pay in January or February of the following year. If you don't pay, coverage lapses back to when you last paid, June 30th of 1999. If there was no coverage, if you don't pay, how can something be extended? Clearly, it's not a future premium at that point. It's a past premium. It's already accrued. Subsequent to that, they have tried to do that. Now,
Counsel, if I understood what you said about the subsequent ones, they violated the statute as well. Just sending it out into the future didn't solve the basic issue that you've raised because there was still no rule.
Right. What happens is
so on there's never been a rule adopted.
Subsequent to there, I think in either late 99 or 2000, I think it was 2000, they'd actually adopted a rule. When they got the Court of Appeals decision, rather than say we have to recalculate this, what they said was, on your next bill, you're going to pay the full amount that's automatically going to be credited back on your next bill. Completely contravened what the Court of Appeals told them to do. Not saying we're going to adopt the rule to do this. They said, here's your money back. We're going to have to bill you 100% because what the Court of Appeals said, don't worry about it. Here's the exact same credit for it on the next bill. Still no rule.
So they have dealt with the 99 with some notice to employers about...
The only notice was the Court of Appeals said to do this, we're going to show that we're collecting it on the next bill, but we're going to forgive it on that bill too.
But they did they'd pass the rule?
Not at that point. It was subsequent to that.
When did they adopt the rule?
I think there was... And I'm not sure of this, I could look. I think one was in November of 99, and then there was, I think it was an emergency bill that was passed by the governor.
So if we affirm, what becomes the status of this 99?
Clearly the administrator had a duty to collect premiums. When you look to and to say that the complaint says anything about injunctive relief, look at it. We specifically asked in a prayer for relief to maintain the funds that have accumulated in the state insurance funds. And those past funds are the ones that accumulated. Collect them. Collect them without superimposing some unlawful dividend on top of them.
So if we affirm, is there then a subsequent dispute about what they did next? Because would they argue that, look, we collected this in the next period after this was announced?
Yeah, they didn't, though. They didn't collect anything. That $633 million plus the $40 million for the 3% refund they gave at that same time, both of them under 32, is still out there. It needs to be collected.
You think they need to send bills out to all the employers in the state of Ohio saying, pay $633 million back, and then we'll figure out what we can do with the surplus? Right.
As to the procedure, you know, it would be okay to send it back to the Bureau and say develop a plan over a reasonable period of time to recoup the monies that you unlawfully gave back.
What authority do they have to do that? If we follow the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals says you can't do this, you got to get a refund back. what authority do they have to do a graduated plan? According to your theory, if we stick by the law that you want us to follow, they have to send a bill out saying pay back the 633.
Nowhere in the Court of Appeals did they say pay the money back. That was the Bureau's interpretation of that.
What did the Court of Appeals say in your interpretation?
Writ was granted. You cannot return this premium because it's not a future premium.
Okay.
The dividend rides on its back.
But they've already done it, right?
Yes.
So what would you say is the lawful remedy, not a made-up procedure because you say we have to follow the rules. What is the lawful remedy that you want us to impose if we were to affirm the Court of Appeals?
The lawful remedy is to compel the administrator, the public official in the agency, the Bureau of Workers' Compensation, to act in accordance with the statutory authority that says you shall collect premiums without any superimposition of an unlawful dividend or refund because you didn't do it according to the statute that you're trying to give it back under.
Now, you're giving me a bunch of semantics. What do they send to the employer? A bill?
They would have to recoup it from the employers.
So you send them a bill and say, pay this back. Is that what you think we should do?
Yes.
And
whether it's a one-time deal or whether it's over time, we're not saying you have to go get it now, but do it over a reasonable period of time.
But what
develop a plan.
What authority do they have to do it over a reasonable period of time? You're wanting us to follow strict rules. What authority do they have? Do they have to pass a new rule to do that?
No, there's no rule that says when they collect this back. They were supposed to collect it. They didn't. They still haven't collected it. So something's better than nothing. Do it over time.
So they collect it, they still have a surplus. What do they do with the surplus?
You know what? They can do what the statute allows them to do, but they cannot take action outside the statute, and that's what they've done here. That's the problem. If they're going to take this action, they can't do it.
Let me ask you a couple questions about standing. Why is this not an injunctive action, and how are your clients harmed by what the Bureau did?
Okay. The harm is that the fund, there's no safeguards, legal or otherwise, to protect any amount of the dividend to go for what that money was earmarked for, a trust fund for injured workers and their dependents. Now, it's flatly inconsistent with the core purpose of workers' compensation. It's to provide compensation for injured workers. The result of this unlawful action, future claims. Now, with the anthrax coming on, who knows what comes about for that?
We're going back to when this action was, when the Bureau made the act, took the action, and how is your, I mean, if the fund has the amount of money in it that it's supposed to have legally, to provide coverage for any injured worker of your clients, how are you harmed by them? If the fund was insolvent, that'd be one thing, but the fund is very solvent. How are you harmed specifically by giving a refund to the employers when there's a huge surplus in the fund?
I see my time's expired, man.
You can answer.
You have to understand if they're allowed, it goes beyond just this solvency of the fund. If they're allowed to ignore this statute, it impugns the integrity of the whole workers' compensation statute. What's next? Which provision next might they not follow? Whether it be permanent total disability, temporary total, whatever. It involves the integrity of the statute. Once you abrogate that integrity, how do you ever gain it back? And say, well, you know, we took it in the big picture, and in the big picture of things, we decided we didn't have to act this way. And really, they're saying we're not bound by the statute, and they've actually in their brief said, and not any court, including this court, can really offer any type of judicial review of that.
How about the injunction? This sure looks like an injunction to me.
This is almost identical to the Voinovich case. The Voinovich case says take no action under appropriation bill until this is resolved.
Let's assume we don't follow the Voinovich case.
Okay.
We distinguish it. Isn't it injunctive in nature?
No. All you have to do is look to the complaint itself when it talks about to maintain the funds. That's the duty of the administrator, to collect those funds and maintain those funds in there. How's that injunctive? We're not saying don't maintain the funds. We're saying maintain the funds.
Well, you're saying, Bureau, don't do what you intend to do.
Don't do what you're supposed to do without implementing the necessary rules.
No, you're saying, Bureau, you've made a mistake. You're not following law, so stop doing what you were doing. That's injunction, isn't
it? No, we're saying don't take the action you're taking without implementing the necessary rules. if you can't follow the statute, that's your obligation as a public official. That's what the statute charged you with. You must follow that. Don't try to superimpose some extra dividend on top of that.
In other words, Bureau, if you want to do something that you that you're about to do, do it pursuant to the statute.
Correct.
Which is mandamus.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dolly, you saved about a half a minute of your time.
I'll be brief, Your Honor. I want to clear up the issue of the rule. We had a rule as of October of 99. So actually, before any decision was issued in this case by the Magistrate Court of Appeals, at any point in time, we had a rule 41.
But you did not have a rule on March 11th.
That's
adopted rule at that time.
That's correct, Your Honor. But so as of October of 99, we had a rule, and all subsequent premium reductions have been done with a rule in place.
But your position is you didn't need the rule to do that.
We did not need a rule, and we have cited Condi, Hoover.
Well, why wouldn't you need a rule if you were proceeding under point 32?
Well, because it, based upon the authority that I've cited in the Hoover case, the Dressler-Cole case, the statute was so specific that it gave clear guidance and standards upon which to govern the conduct of the agency in issuing the premium. The statute said, when you have excess surplus, you can return premium. You can do two things: give cash rebates or reduce future premium. That's exactly what the statute said. It was very clear, and in fact, the subsequent rule, which was adopted, really, is further support that it was so clear that the subsequent rule simply mirrors the language of the statute that says.
But the statute is specific. But the statute is specific and requires a rule.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I think it's in these kinds of situations where even though it says you shall have a rule, that there are some situations where an agency has statutory authority to act.
But
without the rule.
But is that your place? If the statute says you must adopt a rule, we're not just talking in this case because you could give that same argument and do a lot of things without rules. And there's a reason why you have to adopt a rule, because there are procedures, adherence, et cetera, that you have to go through. So it isn't up to you to decide whether this is a case we should adopt a rule, the statute's so clear, we don't need a rule.
I agree with that, Your Honor.
Why adopt a rule if you know that the statute was so clear and you really didn't need it?
I mean, then the reason we did is to avoid any further litigation over whether we needed a rule. We certainly believe one was not needed because there was specific authority that was given.
In some place on that very subject, I read that you said if this case is affirmed, no big deal, we'll just go back and do it the way the statute says and everything will work out all right. Isn't that your position, that you can comply with the Court of Appeals opinion if we affirm this?
Well, I believe that you can comply, but again, the problem is what I've said is what this decision has done is really created greater uncertainty and difficulty in managing the fund,
Constant.
Not really protecting the fund.
Your red light's on, but I think you appreciate the part of what's happened here is concern brought to us on behalf of some workers that this fund became and the surpluses became a political issue. I'm an employer. I get the notices, and there was more back patting going on when those notices came out about how well the fund had been managed and all of that. And what they seem to be saying is, you need a rule and a process so that there's an opportunity for input on the issue of how much is the surplus.
Well, what I would say is that, what I would like to say is that when we went through the rulemaking process, no comment, no objection, rule passed, mirroring the language of the statute, and we've enacted other premium reductions based upon that rule without any challenge.
And isn't that what the Oversight Commission does that has labor management on it?
That's the other thing that I wanted to say, Your Honor, is that, you know, this was done with the approval of the Oversight Commission that is represented by all interests that are involved in the Bureau of Workers' Comp, labor, employees, the lawyers. I mean, you know, everyone is represented and everyone agreed and approved with that.
You've used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.